All right, last hour on this Friday. A year ago, we were inside doing remote shows, and it was snowing. Somebody told me we got 4 inches of snow a year ago today. We just got cloudy skies and rain. And we got Dirk Chatelain from the World Herald, who will brighten up our day. How are you? How's your week?
It's going good. Somehow Josh Peterson had to be in the thick of that, I'm imagining. There was some sort of prediction before that that made it look worse.
Well, we've been good for a nice little April snowstorm from time to time. I remember there was a late April series when I was doing Nebraska baseball against Kansas State that got snowed out.
Yeah, it is. It's not completely out of the ordinary, but the nice part is they typically don't stay around very long. I don't think last year's was around more than about 24 hours. So.
Hey, let's do a little recap. We talked extensively about the Masters last week. Now that it's over and Matsuyama won, it's great for him. It's great for his country. I don't know what it does for the sport. The TV ratings were, he had a four-shot lead going into Sunday. Didn't give it back. He methodically putted really well and won a green jacket. What was your recap on the Masters?
Well, I think it's probably a long-term boost for golf because it expands, you know, golf into makes it more prominent in Asia and makes it more worldwide sport, all that, which I think is good for the sport. I don't think it does much for people like you and me. I think that, you know, it's not so much about Matsuyama. I just didn't, there wasn't much, nobody could make a run, and the big names certainly couldn't make a run. And so I thought that took more spice out of it than who won. So that part was unfortunate, but man, it was just really fun to see that golf tournament back after 2 years. I mean, we're gonna say that about a lot of things, I think, in 2021, but that was right near the top of my list, was seeing a sort of a vintage Masters where it played the way that you wanted it to play. And I missed that last year, and I think a lot of people did too. So sort of the unofficial start of the golf season.
It is.
You know, I think if I think it's, you know, if Jordan Spieth is going to stay this interesting the rest of the year, I think it'll be a pretty good year for the sport.
And it might be a good year around here because the U.S. Senior Open is here, Pinnacle Bank Championship is back, and it was just a couple of years ago that a guy that looks like Happy Gilmore's caddy, Will Zalatoris, finished 56th. He won $1,600 in Omaha, got in his car, and drove to the next tour stop.
You know, I was out there that week, and this is always the way this stuff works, but if I would have known, you know, known then what I know now, I would have spent time following him that week. But it's crazy in this sport. And, you know, in some degrees, it happens in other sports, too. I mean, there's football players who come out of the CFL, and there's, you know, basketball players who come out of the G League and all this stuff. But golf, the line between just nobody's ever heard of him and everybody's heard of him is so thin. It's really fun to look back on that stuff. You know, I frankly did not remember Zalatoris playing in Omaha, but I was just curious because I knew what tour he was playing on 2 years ago. And I Googled him. I Googled that leaderboard from 2 years ago or a year and a half ago. And sure enough, you know, he's +3 or whatever he was. So he could handle Augusta National, but he could not handle Indian Creek. And I think Indian Creek should put that on a billboard somewhere.
But, you know, that sport is so strange and so difficult that you had the weekend where you had a lot of unknown names but good golfers that were on the first page, and you had the champion who didn't make the cut and some other really good golfers that were 40th and 50th. It is a sport that is great. And then it's a sport that it just is a strange game, and it's befuddling what it does to you.
Well, you're absolutely right. And what other, how many other sports could you take a guy? I mean, you take a guy, you know, number 20 in the world, number 50 in the world, and on a given week, you know, you put that guy on a mini tour at Dakota Dunes in Sioux City or something like that, and you know, he might not win the tournament. You know, it's just a goofy game. Guys are really prone to volatility. You know, it's it takes long sample sizes to really distinguish between great players and mediocre players. It's just a fascinating sport to follow. And then you get guys like Jordan Spieth who Ricky Fowler, who might just lose it for, you know, 2 or 3 years at a time. I mean, sometimes longer than that. I mean, David Duval lost it, never got it back. So it's a really fascinating, maddening sport. But it's just interesting how, you know, Augusta National tends to bring out a lot of that volatility, a lot of that interest. It's partly the golf course. It's partly the pressure. It's partly the time of year. There's just lots of stuff, lots of variables there that make it, you know, just such a great drama. And it wasn't great this year, but it was still the Masters.
Where's Ricky Fowler?
I mean, the funny answer is, you know, riding the coattails of Justin Thomas and Jordan Spieth to NHL hockey games. But no, the reality is, I think he's just going through a Spieth-like funk, if not even deeper than Spieth's funk. And, you know, the sad part for Ricky is he doesn't have the same track record to fall back on. I mean, he wasn't a winner of those major championships. He's got a Players' Championship, but it's, you know, he never felt like he quite reached the mountaintop. And then, you know, now he's way down next to the B lift on the blue slopes. So it's been a tough run for him, and, you know, hopefully he'll get it back. But again, that's just sort of the nature of the sport.
How much attention do you pay to information that comes out of spring football these days?
You know, I don't follow it right now as much as I would have 5 years ago, for sure. That doesn't mean that I don't follow it at all, because I think, you know, Nebraska has some interesting stuff going on. But you know, I don't. This is not a knock on the players or the coaches or anything like that. I find it to be a year where, you know, it's more about substance than style. And I think to get that substance, you know, we're going to have to wait for the fall. So, I have a lot of respect for, you know, the grind of it and the media following the grind and producing, you know, great content, and no knock on any of that. But it feels like more of a year where, okay, wake me up come August. And, you know, I think that's just probably based on Nebraska's struggles. And, you know, some of the personnel is pretty exciting. I think, you know, some of the new guys on offense, and you've got a defense that really has some name recognition that I think is pretty fun. You know, it's going to be a fun team to follow on defense, because I think fans are going to know these players, and they're not going to need to consult the program the way they sometimes do when Nebraska runs out a new black shirt defense. There's going to be a lot of guys that you remember and have, you know, prior feelings for. But it just feels like a season where I don't even know if Nebraska's coaches really will have an idea of how good they are until they get out there, you know, in September and they're playing good teams. I mean, Oklahoma's going to wake them up pretty fast. But it just feels like a year where we need to wait and see and kind of, you know, resist the urge to get ahead of ourselves.
Well, and you know, there's a lot of optimism in spring. You're 0-0. There's some new guys that I think they have every right to be excited about. They got a new toy at wide receiver. They got a young running back from Georgia who has taken advantage of his opportunity. But you know how it's become around here in the dynamic of, okay, you don't want to get too excited about some developments. And then if you do, I look at like the guys that are on, the guys and the gals that are on the beat every day, and they're just writing stories for content. You know, they're doing interviews. It's the daily stuff. So they're writing stories, and they'll get the knock of, oh, geez, you're trying to feed us the Kool-Aid. I mean, that's where we're at, where it just adds to August 28th can't get here soon enough for this program. It just can't. I mean, because there's nothing they can do between now and August 28th.
I don't get the sense that the media is, you know, getting out ahead of, you know, over its skis too far, where leading fans down the road of hype and, you know, all that. I don't get the sense that the media is doing that. It's interesting how I think so much of how we respond as a fan base is based on our last impression. And our last impression is the last 2 years.
have just, it's felt, this is probably too strong of a word, but it's felt a bit fraudulent. You know, it just, it felt like the program had set us a line for, you know, for 8 months, 9 months, and we just kind of got exposed. And I don't mean that as we as a fan base. I just mean we as consumers. Like, it just didn't feel like we had, we got what we bargained for, or what we expected. And I think so people are naturally very careful right now. I think the coaches are being careful, you know, not to say something that they're going to regret later. And all of this, I think, is fairly healthy. I mean, it's, especially because I think it creates a sense of motivation and drive in the locker room. I mean, if you don't think Adrian Martinez, Cam Taylor-Britt are about as determined as possible to make amends for the last 2 years, you know, I think you're underestimating their competitiveness. And I think that's all a positive. So while the mood or the aura around the program isn't what it was 2 years ago or even 1 year ago, I don't think that's a bad thing. I think Nebraska has sort of been humbled and recognizes that it just frankly has to get better personally and as a team in order to merit the type of hype that it received over the last year.
You know, when we cover coaches or players and they might drop the line, well, I don't read anything you write. I don't pay attention to the radio. I don't pay attention to the TV. I think it's a development, and I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing. I get the sense hearing from coaches, even the head guy, not so much him, but he does a little bit, but more of his assistants, that they are paying attention to what happens outside of the walls of North Stadium, that people are disgruntled. They want things to happen now. Now, nobody wants them to have success more than the people that's their job and that's their day-to-day grind is to make that football program better. But I think it's okay, and I think it's an okay sign that they are cognizant of, you know, people are very disgruntled. They want things to happen now, and they know that, but they're okay publicly alluding to that.
Yeah. No, I think that's true. And I think most times, I'm not trying to prop up our profession here, but I think most times they're lying to you when they say that I don't pay attention to, you know, what's happening outside these walls. You know, they're either directly reading it or they're made aware of it by someone. You know, if Michael Sevier goes on a rant at 7:30 on a Monday morning following a loss to Northwestern, you know, and shouting profanities and expletives as he's prone to do, you know, that's going to get back to somebody down. And, you know, I won't go too deep into specifics, but, you know, sometimes just things that I've tweeted over the years has gotten back to people down there, and they've alluded to it sometimes months later. So they're, you know, they're aware, but as you said, I think it creates a pretty healthy pressure when they're at least aware of what the mood is outside of the walls. And that doesn't mean that it has to distract them or, you know, change the way they coach a team, but I think having an understanding of the urgency in the community is generally a positive thing.
Dirk Chatelain from the World Herald joining us. Interesting week for Creighton. We kind of saw that the guys were going to leave. We didn't probably maybe see the Christian Bishop, but they'll have five new starters next year. So it's become kind of a full-on rebuild with some intriguing parts that are already here are going to join the program in their recruiting class. But this week, two guys who have kind of, they've been the poster child for the success of the program, Mitch Balick and Marcus Zagorowski depart. Let me ask you first about Marcus Zagorowski. What will you remember about him? And then I'm going to ask you a question you can add to this. I asked George this the other day. Who has a better career in the NBA? Zagorowski, Patton, or, I mean, I throw Kyrie Thomas in there, even though he's not in the league, or Tyshawn Alexander?
Well, good question, because it's interesting. The second one, I think, is most interesting to me just because there's sort of a new – there's a transition right now in the Creighton NBA alumni base, right? Because, you know, Korver's gotten out. Tolliver's going to be getting out. Doug's obviously in his prime. But, you know, with Patton and Kyrie sort of on the fence or on the edge. I think Creighton's going to have a new wave here eventually of pros. If they're lucky, they'll be as successful as Korver, Tolliver, and McDermott were. I have a hard time predicting too much for any of the guys who are leaving in this cycle. And I would include Zegarowski in that. I just think that, you know, there's that position in NBA basketball is so competitive that I'm just not sure that he, you know, stands out enough to be an NBA point guard. I'm not sure he's explosive enough. I'm not sure he's, you know, a good enough shooter. The beauty of this is, you know, 2 years from now, it might be different. I mean, I think there was an assumption. There's generally an assumption with college basketball, or at least there has been traditionally, that you are as you are when you left college. And I think watching the NBA over the last 10 years, you see some big jumps with guys who leave early and then the player they are 2 years later. So I think he has a chance. I would just be surprised, you know, if he reaches that level, just because I think he has some, you know, size and athleticism deficiencies that really, really high level NBA point guards don't have. I think his legacy at Creighton, though, is pretty set in stone. I mean, he was the best player on the first Sweet 16 team in 47 years. You know, I think he really played with a lot of, I think a lot of leadership, a lot of character. You know, I think he was just sort of the model guy. And, you know, I think the injury at the end of last year would have taken a lot of sting out of that season. But they got knocked out of the tournament anyway by COVID. So that was less of an issue. You know, with these guys who leave early, and I would include Tyshawn in this, there's always a little bit of a what if. Like, man, you know, what if you could have came back and been one of the 10 greatest players in Creighton history if you would have stuck it out one more year? And there's always a little bit of regret and what if in those scenarios. But you know, I think Zegarowski probably, like Bowick, looked around the room and said, this is not going to be the same team next year. We are going to be fighting to stay 500 and probably in the bottom half of the Big East. And based on that, you know, he just decided that it was time for his next challenge. And I don't begrudge him at all. I think, you know, Creighton fans were, even the most optimistic, were probably thinking that it would be hard to have more than one starter back next year. And as it stands, they're going to go 0-5, and I'm not surprised by that at all. I think once a couple guys made the decision, it just gets harder for those other guys to want to come back and try it again in an environment and with a level of success that probably didn't meet their personal standard.
You know, going back to the NBA discussion, and this is the time of the year where people are putting their name into the NBA draft. They're foregoing their collegiate eligibility, or they just want to, you know, get a feel of what the NBA thinks about them. It is so difficult to make the NBA. I mean, it just is. There's only two rounds. It's the best of the best, but there are so many players that think they can play in the NBA or want to play in the NBA. And at the end of the day, there's probably only 35 to 40 guys coming out of college that are going to make it onto an NBA roster, and only an even a smaller group that are going to be starters next year in the NBA. It's that time of the year where we try and debate whether guys, you know, how they would do in the NBA or if they're making the right decision.
I don't want to disrespect football players because I think it's extraordinary what they do. And I don't think they're appreciated, respected, or paid enough. But there is so much turnover in the NFL that sometimes you'll get a guy who you just say, man, I didn't think he was going to make it. And there he is. You know, he's playing on special teams. He's a backup DB. He's the, you know, 48th man on this roster, whatever. The NBA is the opposite because the longevity is just extraordinary now. I mean, guys, you know, I'm not sure that's changed, but it's just these guys stick, you know. If you're good enough, you're gonna stick for a while. And so it's really hard to make a roster just because, you know, who's going to knock Doug McDermott out of the NBA in the next 5 years? Nobody's going to do that. You know, he might not be a starter, but you're not getting that guy out of the out of a rotation or off a roster. I mean, Anthony Tolliver, you know, how many times did somebody probably 25 years old think they were going to beat him out, and they couldn't do it? You know, there's just, these guys stick, and so it's really, really hard to make a team. And there's, it's more competitive than ever, partly because of international basketball, partly because of the G League. It's just really hard to make it. And so I guess what's interesting to me, though, and if there's a trend here, it's that I think guys make the jump. I think they leave college knowing they're not going to make the NBA right away. And that did not happen 20 years ago. I mean, it was,
yeah,
if guys
true.
Left early, they had the expectation, I'm going to get drafted, I'm going to make a roster, I'm going to be a rookie in the NBA. Well, now it's totally different. I mean, you see guys all over the place who are saying, you know, I'm probably not going to make a roster next year. I know that, but I'm going to play in the G League, or I'm going to play somewhere else. I'm going to play professional basketball somewhere, and I'm going to continue my development and hopefully one day reach the NBA. It's like college basketball is not the launching point. It's just sort of the first stepping stone in the process. And I think that part has changed.
I think that guy you're talking about is Isaiah Roby.
Yeah. No, you're exactly right. I don't think Roby left thinking that he was going to make it right away. But you just, you know, if you can put yourself in competitive environments, part of it is the personal trainer stuff and all the things that guys do in the off season. You know, part of it is just the development of some of those intermediate professional leagues. But there really is an expectation now that 2021, 22-year-olds are going to keep getting better, even outside of college basketball. And I think generally that's a good thing, but it definitely kind of changes the read when a guy like Zygurowski or, you know, Damian Jefferson or whoever leaves earlier than they could have left. Because I think, you know, ordinarily we would look at that and say, are you a fool? Why are you leaving early when you're not even going to get drafted? Well, the reality is those guys are going to develop at a higher rate in the G League than they are in college basketball, and they know that. So it just sort of changes the environment.
And it'll change the sport along with everything else that is going on. Dirk, as always, I appreciate it. Have a good weekend.
Okay, take care. Thank you.
That's Dirk Chatelain from the World Herald. You know, leaving for another opportunity, whether it be to go get paid or another school. We might have to have a bell here. We are closing in on 1,400 players in the college basketball transfer portal.
Wow.
Could we get to 2,000 players? Do the math here real quick. So there are 353 Division I basketball programs. I got the calculator out.
Okay,
here.
Good.
You know what? Have you ever tried to explain to a young kid that we used to have calculators that actually were like separate from your phone?
Yeah. The looks on their faces.
So 353 times, let's say, 12. Okay, so that's 4,236 players. 2,000 of them could be in the portal. They're also, the year after the pandemic, there have been quite a few coaching changes as well. But we're closing in on 1,400 players and possibly could get to 2,000. Whew. Ooh. So there's also, you never know who's going to join the portal. Like, I know we're getting, you know, some Creighton fans are wondering, okay, why is it taking so long? How come they can't get anybody? They keep, you know, coming up short on these guys. Well, there's some really, really good players that are still in the portal. And today, a 19-point score at a mid-major went into the portal. I mean, you could wait a while and take care of yourself. You know, people were asking me, okay, what's Omaha doing? Well, Omaha got, you know, Chandler from Wichita State today. It might be okay to kind of sit around. Not everybody is getting C.J. Wilcher from Xavier right away out of the portal. But 1,400 players. I bet by the end of the day, there are 1,400 players that are in the portal. Are they all going to find a spot?
No, there's no room.
Then there's the part, if you're a brand new coach and your roster has just departed, portal, baby. Build it up. Win one of those top 15 guys that is in the portal.
Yeah.
And you know, then you're off to an okay start. We sit here and we watch it with amusement. It's a love-hate relationship, but you have to have a strategy. Nick Saban said yesterday, Nick Saban had a great response. He said, we have a strategy. Alabama doesn't necessarily win the portal in football. They lose quite a few guys, you know, that get on campus and reality hits that they've got, even though they were a five-star, they got four or five stars that are at their same position. And so they're like, I'd like to play, so I'm going to go somewhere else. But even Nick Saban said, we have a strategy with a free transfer. What is scary in their being Alabama in the portal is the fact that now between SEC schools, there's no block. Hey, we just beat them out of Ole Miss. I really like that left tackle. You like Alabama? We got a scholarship for you. Now, that would be tough as a coach. I would be here for it because that would be Saban taking somebody from Kiffin. But that's probably the next part of all of this is that you can transfer in conference with no penalty. And what that'll do to relationships and what that'll do to rivalries. And what'll that all do to some tampering that will go on.
Oh, yeah. That's a good point.
All right, 126. George will be back. We got some chatter about the NBA. Last night was good night for Curry. Good night for the Celtics. Bad night for Charles Barkley. I'll explain. It could be a great weekend for Major League Baseball if they would actually put the two best rivalries in baseball going on TV. No, it's not the Braves and the Cubs, which actually will be on TV Sunday night. I wonder if Alex Rodriguez will be there.
Oh.
Will he be okay to be remotely doing the game on Sunday night?
Maybe if they have Coldplay playing.